Chris Cooper, political science professor, Western Carolina University. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, always good to see you. And we just got done with session. It's been a few weeks now off, so the session has cooled off a little bit, but I guess we're going to be seeing lawmakers back in Raleigh pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sort of this interesting thing that's happened, right? We were supposed to have a long session and a short session, and the rest of the time our legislators are supposed to be at home in this kind of citizen legislator model. But what we've really seen is kind of a deviation from that, right? We've already called a special session in August. So we're getting multiple, I think it was six special sessions last year. So at a certain point, you start to wonder, hey, do we really have this citizen legislature anymore? Or have we kind of morphed into more of a full-time legislature?
Yeah. And my question with that, I guess my main question is, you know, we have these deadlines where certain bills are supposed to be filed and passed through one chamber. Does that still apply when we're talking about special sessions, or are they pretty much free to bring up whatever they want?
You know, there are certain rules, but yeah, the crossover rule is sort of the traditional, hey, everything needs to have crossed over to the other chamber in a regular legislative session. But there's no crossover corollary really in these special sessions, right? We don't really know how long they're going to be there, so they don't set the crossover deadline. So it's a little bit more of a free-for-all. And there are certain rules about what can be brought up. They have to have sort of signaled them in a regular session, but most of the rules are off.
Here's a tough question for you, Chris. How healthy is our democracy in North Carolina?
You know, it's a great question. And it's one I think about a lot. I think less healthy than it should be. And I'll give you one example related to what we're talking about. Our legislators are being paid at this point $13,951 a year, right? So $14,000 a year, basically, to govern our state in an indeterminate number of days a year. So it's really hard if you're a legislator to plan your legislative calendar and, frankly, to plan your life. And I think that's even tougher when you live out west. If you're a Jim Davis and you're representing, you know, NC Senate District 50, as far west as you can get, it's a good 5 hours to Raleigh. And that's assuming there's no traffic on 40. So what that means is for democracy, it's tough, right? We're expecting these folks to kind of pull off a miracle, to be at home with us and to be in Raleigh at the same time.
You super impressed me by knowing that figure down to the dollar off the top of your head. No notes.
I'm going to
let our listeners know.
No notes. No notes. It's the curse of teaching.
Yeah. Well, so what does that do? I mean, is that a case where we've got people who are only from a certain social status that can actually serve in the legislature?
You know, this is a debate right now. And so the argument against our type of legislature has been, yeah, that the only people who can choose to run are retired folks and folks who, frankly, have a lot of money and don't need to work daily, right? So if you decided to run for office, you'd have to quit your job, right? CQS is not going to be okay with you. BPR is not going to be okay with you guys going back and forth between here and Raleigh. So it is a different type of person who's going to run, and I think that's particularly important out west. It's one thing if you live around Raleigh, maybe you can pull this off, even Durham. But if you live in Franklin or Asheville or Silva or Hendersonville, it's a real commitment to run for office. And so, yeah, the sense is, hey, maybe we're getting folks who aren't really representative.
Yeah, and speaking of the health of our democracy, we've got all these court challenges to our maps. We've got an uncertain situation there. What are you looking at when it comes to our maps in the future here?
You know, I mean, there's a few things going on, right? So you've got the cases that are based on racial gerrymandering, and those are the ones that are really active in North Carolina right now, and they are important, and they're going to give us some new maps coming very soon. Then you've got these cases nationally, like the one in Wisconsin, that are about partisan gerrymandering, and those also have the potential to change the way that our districts are structured in our state. And I think this is a good indication of, is our democracy healthy or not, right? We want to choose our legislators. We don't want our legislators to choose who they're representing, right? That's not the way it's supposed to work. And on both parties, I think we've seen an increasing amount of legislators choosing who they would like to represent. That's not the way the system's supposed to work.
So I think the Wisconsin case may be more significant to this state than the racial gerrymanders. Mm-hmm. Is that your opinion as well?
Yeah, absolutely, especially out west, right? So the racial gerrymandering cases are very important, but the court's been pretty consistent. The court said, look, you can't gerrymander based on a race, and they've said that time and time again. The Wisconsin case is really the first time where the court has said, nor can you gerrymander based on partisanship. So for those of us out west, really, this is a much more important decision. So just to take the North Carolina 11th, for example, we were the most competitive district in the state in the 11th congressional district, and then we moved to the most Republican district in the state overnight. And I think this kind of partisan gerrymandering, what the Wisconsin decision says is, hey, we're wasting too many votes, in their words. So we would actually have to redraw our congressional districts based not on race, but based on partisanship.
I think I know the answer to this, but are you at all surprised by the level of discord between Governor Roy Cooper and the legislature?
Not so much, right? I mean, I think this was set up. Roy Cooper's got the toughest, love him or hate him, he's got the toughest job in American politics right now. He starts off as one of the least powerful governors in the country. Just the North Carolina governor's not set up as being particularly powerful. Then the legislature strips away more of his power, and he's facing a supermajority. So the fact that they haven't, completely rewritten our calendar to make it, anti-Roy Cooper Day is maybe the only win he's going to get this year.
I like that. One of the most significant things I thought I saw, like towards the end, was the cuts to the Department of Justice in the budget. Have you looked at that at all? And do you have you looked at what kind of impact that could have?
Yeah, I think it's going to have a real impact, right? So the question is, are folks that underworked? And so this cut is going to involve really mostly personnel, right? Most state budget cuts are really personnel cuts, right? Most of our money is kind of locked up in personnel. So what that means is you're going to be dismissing full-time attorneys, essentially. And so you can have fewer people working on the same number of cases. And so the question is, hey, is this a more efficient government, or is this a government that's going to work slower? And I think depending on where you sit on the partisan aisle probably determines the answer to that question.
How powerful do you think the people of North Carolina are? Because, you know, when I look at a budget getting passed by the Senate, a budget getting passed by the House, then they go into session behind closed doors. And, you know, I read news stories about, you know, whether it's the UNC Law School, they're lobbying for less cuts. You know, I don't know how far that lobbying goes. And I'm wondering if you think the people of North Carolina feel they have any power, or if they even do have much power in this.
Yeah, I think they don't feel that they do. I think this is true in most states at this point, right? People talk about efficacy, right? So the idea is, you know, if I'm efficacious towards government, I think, gee, government makes a difference in my life, and people like me have a say in government. And that number is going lower and lower and lower in North Carolina. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is, we're a split partisan state, right? We're a purple state. So almost by definition, half of our state is going to be upset at all times. And so it's really hard to make everyone feel like you're connected, when the reality is, half the folks are going to lose out. We still have more registered Democrats and Republicans in the state. And if you're a registered Democrat in the state, you're probably not feeling like you have a whole lot of power, like you're not being heard very much.
When you look at some of the bills that were passed, what are some of the ones that stand out to you?
The brunch bill is certainly interesting, right? So Now we can, in certain places, we're allowing local control over brunch. That one's really more of a fun one. Look, I mean, I think the budget in any legislative cycle is the most important thing that happens, or certainly in what's called the long session, right? So they pass the new budget. That's by far the most important thing that this legislature did. As far as other bills, you know, I was a little bit surprised that voter ID did not come up and get passed. It will, it looks like, in the special session in August. So I think the absence of that has been particularly important. Other than that, I think it was, you know, there's not a lot of headline bills. If we think about things the legislature's done in the past, HB2, certainly voter ID, some of these redistrictings in the past, there's nothing like that that I think folks are going to be talking about kind of across the country.
One of the bills that stood out to me, I think, was that renewable energy bill. Mm-hmm. It looked like it was something that, like, it was a deal worked out between Duke Energy and a bunch of solar companies. And then this wind moratorium was tacked on to that. So that likely won't affect us out here in the West, but we'll speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important. I think it speaks to kind of the question before about the health of our democracy and kind of who has power, right? I think what you're maybe seeing are some lobbying groups that are able to express a good bit of power. And I think this could be important for folks across the state. Obviously, it's an environmental issue that matters regardless of kind of where you live. It's also hooked to economic development. I think it represents this broader tension we have in the state and the country as a whole, right? You've got folks saying, hey, we need to press for more renewable energy. And other people are saying, hey, what about the jobs that are in kind of old traditional energy? And I think that battle is kind of one we saw played out in this session.
If I were to look back at the beginning of the session and I asked who were the lawmakers to watch from out here in Western North Carolina, I would have said Chuck McGrady, probably at number one. What do you think? Who are the people to look at?
You know, I think McGrady is a great example. He has carved out a very interesting niche in North Carolina politics. He has become a Republican who's kind of trusted a little bit more than most Republicans by the Democrats, I think. I mean, he's been, if you think about the folks in the middle or maybe the deal makers, if you will, I think McGrady has become known as that pretty quickly. He's a little less hard line than some of the other folks in the supermajority. So I think he's been incredibly important statewide. You know, I think Jim Davis, the senator from 50, has continued to be an influential senator, certainly tax a lot harder, right, is a much more conservative voice, but has continued, I think, to be a bit of a power player in Raleigh. You know, some of our freshmen, you know, Mike Clampett, from everything I'm hearing, actually, you know, was able to have a little bit of traction this year. And I think perhaps the years that he spent as marshal in the General Assembly really kind of paid dividends and helped him understand a little bit more about kind of what is the role of a freshman. So certainly he was not exerting huge power, but at the same time, I think he understood what is the role of a freshman. And I think he was able to figure out a few types of issues to be involved in, generally those around kind of first responders.
Jim Davis, you mentioned he's been there for a little while. So is it just seniority that really puts you ahead?
You know, I think that's a lot of it, right? Rare is the legislator who can come in and wield a lot of power early on. So seniority really does make a big difference. You know, a guy on the Democratic side, a little bit farther east, but a guy like Jeff Jackson, I think, has been able to do it sooner, frankly, than most. But usually it takes a few cycles to get in and have a lot of power. The North Carolina Center for Public Policy puts out these kind of legislative effectiveness rankings. They're somewhat controversial, but essentially what they do is they survey folks who are knowledgeable at state politics and say, hey, who are the power brokers? And if you look at that list in any session, it tends to be the people in the majority and, of course, the people who have been in the longest. And I think Davis is a good example of that.
Well, shifting national, Congressman Mark Meadows seems to be wielding pretty outsized influence in the Congress. Good for his constituents, I would say, at least his supporters. Where do you see his role? Is it going to continue to rise, or has he reached an apex, do you think?
It's a great question. I think Mark Meadows is a great counterexample to what I just said about the state legislative level, right? Mark Meadows is a guy who's, you know, in his third term, and although it's a district I love, it is not, you know, nationally a very prominent district. But he has become, you know, I'd say one of the top half dozen lawmakers in Washington in influence. And I think he's been able to do that for a lot of different reasons. One, he's got a very secure district. Two, he is, you know, I think a fairly good politician, and he's works pretty well with the media. And I think right now for a Republican in Washington, that's actually a little bit of a little bit unexpected. And I think he's been able to use all of that to carve out this really important niche. So yeah, as head of the Freedom Caucus, he's the guy that's looked at. I think when he tweets out that, hey, he likes the Senate bill with this new Ted Cruz provision, that's actually meaningful. There's a lot of the 435 members of Congress that they tweeted that, it wouldn't matter. Mark Meadows tweets that, it actually means something.
And getting less attention, Patrick McHenry has actually stepped into the role of House Whip after the shooting of Steve Scalise, who is thankfully still alive. And I think he's back in the hospital, but he seems to be doing okay, I think. But anyway, what about Patrick McHenry?
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting kind of study in contrast, right? So Meadows and McHenry have both become extremely powerful and in very different ways. McHenry took what I would call the traditional path to power, right? He's been in office longer. He's worked his way into a traditional power position, right? So if you were to go back to 1920 and you look at the United States Congress, you'll want to know who is acting as the whip. The Freedom Caucus was not a word people used in 1920, right? So Meadows has taken this, what I would call kind of a new style path to power, and McHenry has taken more of a traditional path to power. Meadows is a lot more likely to end up on the Sunday talk shows than McHenry, but McHenry certainly exerts power in his own way. So folks in the West, I think, are represented, whether you're on their side or not on their side ideologically. I think both are wielding a lot of power, again, for an area of the country that isn't traditionally looked at as a power center.
And switching over to the Senate, and I guess we'll leave it at this, but you know, you've got Richard Burr and Tom Tillis. Obviously, the Senate health bill is the big talk of the town right now. They're getting a lot of pressure from constituents. How effective is that? And do you see any chance of one of those, one or both of those guys voting no on that bill?
You know, the question to me is, does it come to a vote, right? I mean, so whether they vote no is an important question, but whether it even gets there. And so what I'd imagine we will see is that, look, if it's not going to pass, the Republican Party is going to know that. And I think they're unlikely to bring it up for a vote. So I think the thing to watch is the rhetorical cues these senators are giving us as much as what their actual votes are. I think it's just kind of the way the game is played right now in Washington. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty about whether the Senate bill will pass, what version of it will pass. Look, Trump, I think, said this morning that he was waiting with a pen for the Senate to pass this. But even if the Senate passes it, it's a long ways to go. It's going to go back to the House. And then they're unlikely to agree wholesale. And then those two need to get together, the House and the Senate, in conference, and then hammer out something different. So no matter what happens, we're a long ways from new health care in the United States.
Well, great. Chris Cooper, always good to have you.
Yeah, great to see you.